Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Israel's intelligence chief told cabinet ministers today that the terrorist attacks last night in two Egyptian resorts were most likely carried out by al-Qaeda. Dozens of people, many vacationing Israelis, were killed and more than 120 wounded when several bombs exploded at the Taba Hilton and at a nearby campground. One wing of the 10-story hotel tore off. Israeli rescue workers have moved heavy equipment to the site to try to save those still trapped under the rubble. Well, joining us from the border crossing between Egypt and Israel is Alon Ben David. He's national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 television, a frequent guest on Here and Now. And Alon, we've seen pictures of these narrow passages that travelers pass through at the borders. What's going on there today?
Well, actually, I moved, and currently I'm standing right outside what is left of the Hilton Taba, and watching those rescue workers trying to find some more survivors or recover more bodies from the hotel. Currently, the border crossing is pretty quiet. There's not much traffic. We've seen a major exodus here of tens of thousands of Israelis that were all along the Sinai beaches, leaving Egypt and going back to Israel. I would guess going back to Israel for a long time, because I can't imagine Israelis going back to the Sinai, at least in the near future. But there were really tens of thousands of Israelis, and I have to say that the Egyptians were allowing them quite a smooth passage, so they came out pretty easily. Some prefer to stay, and some are still vacationing here on the beaches.
Well, Alon, remind us of the geography where you are, you know, the Sinai Peninsula between Egypt proper and Israel. And also remind us of some of the history, because many Americans were surprised to hear that Israelis did vacation in the Sinai.
Well, yeah, and the Sinai beaches are stretching from the southern tip of Israel, which is the city of Eilat. Taba, where the first attack occurred, is about 8 miles south of Eilat. And from there, there's a long beach of the Red Sea, about 300 kilometers, where Israelis travel a lot. Since the peace agreement with Egypt, Israelis looked at the Sinai as their preferred resort. They like it here. They feel at home. Many of them have memories from the time that it was occupied by Israel. And they were traveling here quite often. There has been another attack in the early 80s against Israeli tourists here, which stopped the Israeli tourism into the Sinai for a few years. But then the Israelis came back. So basically we're talking about a long beach stretching from the southern tip of Israel along the Red Sea, about 300 kilometers of beach, starting about 10 kilometers south of Eilat.
Yeah. The government has said that the attack bears the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda attack, but some have also suggested that it might be in retaliation for Israel's recent incursions into Gaza. Your thoughts?
Well, I wouldn't imagine it can be a retaliation. This attack was carefully planned, and you cannot produce something as big as that in just 2 weeks since the operation in Gaza started. I would look at this announcement the responsibility that was assumed in one internet site by an organization called Tawheed, because they gave quite an accurate description of what happened here. They said that four brothers were the perpetrators of the attack, and they were doing it as a revenge for the killing of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the leader of the Hamas movement. Now, Tawheed is another one of those small organizations that are all tagged under the general brand name of Al-Qaeda, what we refer to as the global jihad. Many, many organizations which identify with Al-Qaeda in ideology, but sometimes operate alone. In any case, this attack was very carefully planned, and they had a lot of resources to do this attack, so I don't see a Palestinian connection here. No. This attack was either planned in Egypt or was receiving some help from the nearby Saudi Arabia, but I wouldn't look at the Palestinians as responsible for this attack.
Alon Ben David, we only have a few seconds. You're standing there at the ruined Hilton. I can't imagine that, as you said, Israelis are not going to be coming back. This can't be good for the Egyptian economy in just the few seconds we have.
Yes, it's going to be terrible. I think that not only that Israelis would choose to come here in tens of thousands every holiday will not come, but also the international tourism to this area will be hurt. I think that the Egyptians are very eager to find out exactly what happened and to find who was behind this attack and arrest them.
Alon Ben David, national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV, speaking to us from the Sinai Peninsula. Alon, thank you so much.
For having me.
The two presidential candidates meet for their second debate tonight. On the agenda at the town hall-style meeting in St. Louis, domestic issues and questions from a hand-picked audience of soft supporters, voters who are leaning one way but could be swayed. The tone is expected to be less formal than last week's podium debate, but if this past week's campaign trail attacks are any indication, there could be some angry exchanges as well. Those looking for a little levity might want to wait until late night or the internet. And apparently, many people are. A new parody of presidential candidates John Kerry and George Bush is out today. It's brought to you from the folks at JibJab.com, which previously had the two candidates singing a modified rendition of This Land Is Your Land. The site drew 10 million visitors in July alone and has had more hits than the Kerry and Bush campaign sites combined. This time around, JibJab animators have the Kerry and Bush soundalikes singing Dixie.
Oh, I wish our winning were a bit more certain.
Better call my friends at Halliburton.
We will pay.
So we stay.
Rule the day.
DC Land.
I'm sensitive. I cannot lie.
I love to hug and kiss the sky.
Are they gay?
We won't say.
On our way.
DC Land.
Well, the internet is one source, but the Pew Research Center has found that nearly a quarter of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 get their election news from late-night comedy shows. That's up from 6% of all Americans in the year 2000. This week, David Letterman characterized the tone of the campaign this way.
How about that Mount St. Helens? You folks been following Mount St. Helens?
Yeah.
It's getting ready to erupt, and today John Kerry said it's proof that Bush is losing the war on volcanoes.
And Jay Leno had two unsuspecting college kids take part in a mock TV game show called What's Your Point?
And what do you feel are Senator Kerry's strengths and weaknesses?
I heard somewhere on the news that he was just like, he gets his manicures and stuff, that he's metrosexual.
He's metrosexual? What does that mean?
That it's like straight men, but they get manicures and pedicures, facials. And...
Is that bad?
No, I think every man should do that, actually.
Oh, so you're for it?
Yeah, so there, that's one strength.
That's a strength. He gets his nails done.
Well, that's both funny and sad, because the story to which the young woman refers was a fake, written by the chief political correspondent at Fox News and mistakenly posted on the Fox website this week, for which the network had to apologize. Well, how is the campaign being viewed through the lens of humor? That's the topic we're putting before two veteran humorists, Joel Stein from Time Magazine. Hi, Joel.
Hey, veteran, yeah.
Yes, be funny.
Jeez.
A lot of pressure. And Joe Gardner, staff writer for the online comedy newspaper, The Onion. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
And we've spoken to you before as well. And I just wonder, what's striking you as funny from this past week?
I think it's funny. The funny thing about the Fox News story that you were mentioning is that they say, oh, that was accidentally put up on the website. Like, basically, all you do is hit a keystroke from your word processor and automatically it goes onto the Fox News website.
Oh,
that, I think, is a really funny series of denials.
Do you think they did it on purpose?
I don't know if it was... an edict from Rupert Murdoch himself that we must start to mock the sexual orientation of John Kerry, or the effeteness of John Kerry. But I don't think it was an accident.
Well, but Joel and Joe, the thing about the woman though that was on the Jay Leno show is that she wasn't laughing. She thought that was true.
But Jay was parsing it for us. He was clefting the real from the fake. He was solving those problems, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. He never said that it wasn't true, and sort of there it sits. Well, here's Jon Stewart of Comedy Central's Daily Show, and here's what he had to say about the debate.
Or perhaps we could describe the encounter as a battle between Edwards, the courtly Southern student council-like ass-kissosity.
Oh, I'm sorry, I broke the rule. Well, in fairness, if you feel like you need to go to him, well,
I could use his name now.
I'm sorry, I broke the rule.
Yeah, he started. Yeah, 30 seconds to pay, yes.
Did you get the apple I sent you? Did you get it? And, of course, it was that versus Cheney's...
Terrorists could smuggle a deadly biological agent or nuclear weapon into the middle of one of our own cities.
Unnerving troll under the bridge boogeyman mentality. Or you could see last night as a spirited debate between two...
The senator's got his facts wrong.
What the vice president has just said is just a complete distortion.
Your facts are just wrong, Senator.
Someone did get it wrong, but it wasn't John Kerry and John Edwards.
It's hard to know where to start. There's so many inaccuracies there.
These distortions are continuing.
They're liars.
Joel Stein, Time Magazine, your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's a lot easier than watching the debate, which kind of went nowhere. That's all you need to know, basically. That sums it up for you, I think.
Does it bother you, as Joe has said, that people might do that? They might stop there. No,
honestly, I've always believed this. If you watch any random half hour of CNN or Fox News and compare it to the half hour of The Daily Show, the amount of facts you would get in The Daily Show has to be 10 to 20 times higher than just hearing two people yell the same thing about Lacey Peterson over and over again.
Well, Jay Leno also had some fun with the vice presidential debates, pretending that he was the moderator of the debate in Cleveland. And, you know, did you see this? They had the two images of each of the candidates, and he sat at a desk, and they cut and pasted it all together.
No, we both work, you know, on the fringes of comedy, so we would never, ever watch Jay Leno.
That's kind of accurate.
We would never know.
Well, here's what Jay did.
By the way, sir, how is your heart these days?
It's working.
Senator Edwards, I noticed John Kerry backstage gave you a little pat on the behind before you came out here. He doesn't do that.
Every single day.
Hey, you're not so innocent yourself, Mr. Vice President. I heard you mooned the senator backstage.
And I got applause for that.
All right, let's get right to it. Mr. Cheney, Senator Edwards says that if you're reelected, you and President Bush will invade other countries. If so, who?
The Brits and the Germans and the French, the Chinese, the South Koreans, the Japanese, and others to try to bring them around.
Okay. Senator Edwards, do the Democrats plan on attacking anyone?
Cleveland.
Cleveland?
Yes, ma'am.
Ma'am. Mr. Vice President, you have 30 seconds to respond to that. Hello? The clock is ticking.
As Dick Cheney flatlines.
As they both did during the debate. Ha-ha! Zing!
It was a setup. But, Joe, I want to go back to something you both said. Why do you think that Jay Leno is not funny on the fringes?
Well, I think he's kind of safely ensconced in the sort of... I mean, I was listening to that, and it sort of seemed like a sort of a safe school comedy. Although I have to agree with something, even though it contradicts what I said previously, making me a flip-flopper. I have to agree with what Joel said, that if you watch The Daily Show, you do get a lot more factual information than you do out of watching a half hour of Fox News or a half hour of CNN.
So I just won the debate.
Well, you did. Congratulations. I concede. Joel Stein is the winner between the two of us. But that really didn't present any information. That was just sort of like a little gaggy and a little cute and funny.
Well, we're talking about political humor in the presidential race with Joe Gardner, staff writer for the online newspaper The Onion, Joel Stein, humorist at Time Magazine. Stay right there. Coming up, the First Lady is funny. But is she or anyone off limits? Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With us are Joe Gardner, staff writer for the online newspaper The Onion. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
Joel Stein, humorist at Time Magazine. And hi to you, Joel, as well, I should say.
Yeah, I feel the love.
There have been some spectacular cases from the campaign trail of humor not working. I'm thinking of, I don't know if you've heard the sound of John Kerry standing before an audience, I think it was in Las Vegas, and he was trying to warm up his speech and he told a few jokes that didn't go over and actually said, but seriously, folks. And then there's another example of President Bush apparently was speaking before a group. His speechwriter wrote him that line about weapons of mass destruction. Those weapons of mass destruction have to be here somewhere.
Yeah. That's good. I like that one.
Yeah. Well, by and large, the most successful comedic thing that a president or presidential candidate has ever done was when Ronald Reagan announced that Congress had banned Russia and they'd start the bombing in 5 years. Hilarious!
And there's also the one that I don't think he intended to be funny, but it got a lot of traction when John Kerry said, "Whom among us does not love NASCAR?" Well, let's listen to this exchange that Jay Leno had with First Lady Laura Bush. She was on Leno's show on Wednesday night. He asks her about all the faces the president made in that first presidential debate in Miami.
Well, how about the faces? Because everyone seemed to say he would kind of grimace.
But he was
scowling? Yeah, scowling, yeah.
I didn't see that. I mean, I was on the very front row, and the
Yeah. In person, that didn't really show up that much. But I think he said this morning that, you know, anyone who listened to his opponent say that many things about him would have to make a face.
Oh, well, that's pretty good. Well, that's pretty good. Yeah, I don't know. I guess when you don't have Botox, you can actually move your face.
Joel Stein, Joe Gardner, is there anything new that can be said about Botox and John Kerry's face?
I thought that was a funny joke, Jim, I know.
Oh, see?
Yeah, it's just when he's not doing the written stuff, he's fine.
Yeah, when you come off with the clips. Although I would say that Laura should stay away from the comedy and leave it to her daughters. They do a far better job with the hilarious
man. Stuff. Who wrote that thing? The daughters at the convention?
I think it was it Karen Hughes? That's what I had heard.
I heard that as well.
Oh dear God.
Well, is there anything off limits for you guys? And I'm thinking of wives and kids and
anything that happened to me isn't funny. That's totally off limits.
There goes next week's headline. It was going to be the big Joel Stein extravaganza.
Well, there are some people who think that there are things that maybe should be off limits. We want to listen to a little more of the Daily Show, with a warning for parents that may find this.
They work blue.
Earlier in the week, Dr. Phil had George and Laura Bush on his program. He also had John Kerry and his wife. But John Stewart on the Daily Show poked fun at one of the questions Dr. Phil asked the president and his wife.
If there was something you would say to the parents of America to give them the strength to hang in and go on, we've got epidemic levels of oral sex in the middle schools.
Well, there was no comment needed from John Stewart, just his face. He eventually regained his composure and declared that that problem that Dr. Phil cited really wasn't a problem at all. Your thoughts? I mean, anything off-limits?
What is an epidemic level, by the way?
I don't know. Time Magazine, you know, is supposed to have stricter guidelines than, let's say, The Onion.
Yes, we have to print actual facts, which really makes it take a lot longer, in my opinion.
Are you ever told that you can't say certain things about candidates or the president?
They're not off limits at all. I think the same things I couldn't say about an entertainer applies to the candidates. Now, we probably go tougher on them. I mean, if there was a late-night talk show host that received an epidemic level of oral sex from an intern, I bet we wouldn't have been allowed to really break that or print that. But, you know, when it's the president, it's a whole higher level of scrutiny, so we can do stuff with them we can't do with other people.
And Joe Gardner, I know there's nothing off limits for you. In fact, I'm on your webpage. Here's some of the stories that you're offering. Irrelevant pop stars unite against Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of them, by the way?
Well, we had a little bit of Pearl Jam, some of the Dave Matthews Band, because I'm kind of surprised, because the Dave Matthews Band should be big Bush supporters, considering they're dumping raw sewage into Chicago rivers on a fairly regular, well, not regular basis. They did it once. You can't say that's an epidemic, but that's bad enough. They're all getting.
We
together.
Should explain that was their tour bus, right? That was
yeah.
caught.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dumping
raw sewage.
Not everybody follows. I forget. Not everybody follows like the dumb stories so much as the big stories. Right.
But
that was one of those that hit me.
But what are you trying to say here? Is this is this about the Springsteen tour, or is this a tour you totally made up? I mean, what are you?
No, it's actually. I think it was a little bit fictional, a little bit reality based, and I think we're mainly trying to echo the sentiments that were very adroitly expressed by Alice Cooper when he said that anybody who listens to a pop star for a political or a musician for a political opinion is dumber than the musician themselves.
Before we leave your website, I love the story, older brother accused of cushion fort prisoner abuse. It's about an 11-year-old. Hey, let me read. Following a probe into activities that allegedly occurred inside a couch cushion fort located in the basement of the Nelson home, Keith, 11, has been accused of mistreatment, abuse of power, and sitting on his 8-year-old brother Mark's head for up to 2 minutes at a time. Well, let's leave with two messages from the candidates as interpreted by David Letterman. Perhaps your thoughts on the other side.
Time for a message from John Kerry. Now, listen carefully. This is a message from Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. John?
I believe I need to be put in jail.
Wrong. There's some kind of a disorder there. Ladies and gentlemen, here we have now the George W. Bush Iraqi update. Listen carefully, watch closely. George W. Bush Iraqi update. George?
If Saddam Hussein were in power, the world would be better off, not the world would be worse off, not better off.
Well, that scripted line from George Bush, you know, those weapons of mass destruction have to be around here somewhere. That's actually sounding pretty good right now.
Well, that was a joke on purpose. That was actually, I thought, pretty clever.
Yeah. Joel Stein, humorist at Time Magazine, Joe Gardner, staff writer for the online newspaper The Onion. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
No, thank you.
Next time on Here and Now, Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. He's celebrating his 73rd birthday, the 20th anniversary of his Nobel Peace Prize, and 10 years of South African democracy. We'll spend some time with him. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're having an historic moment here in Boston. The cover of one of the town's two main papers says, "Go Yanks." What? For insight on that and other matters in this year's Major League Pennant race, we turn to Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill.
Robin.
How could Bostonians be rooting for the Yankees?
Isn't that magnificent? It's great fun. Well, the answer is that there are a certain number of fans, and some of them apparently work at the Boston Herald, who believe that a World Series victory by the Red Sox would be hollow unless they beat the Yankees on the way to that triumph. And, of course, if the Yankees can't beat the Twins in their series, the Red Sox will have to beat the Twins to get at the National League champion, and it would just somehow not be entirely satisfying if that happened that way.
Some are saying that if the Red Sox win without the Yankees, you know, being in play, it will have to be a win with an asterisk in the records. Well, let's remind people who is playing. There are eight teams in the playoffs, the Red Sox facing Anaheim, and how's that series going?
Well, the Red Sox are up 2-0 over Anaheim by virtue of the fact that they scored 8 runs in one game and 9 runs in the other. And I think it's safe to say that if they continue scoring 8 or 9 runs a game, they'll be just fine through the rest of the postseason. 8 or 9 runs wins a lot of baseball games.
Is Anaheim not playing well, or are the Red Sox playing particularly well?
Anaheim is playing inconsistently, and they are playing under the disadvantage of having several guys, at least two guys, out of position. They've got a guy at third base who isn't used to it. They've got a guy at second base who isn't used to it. This is because of injuries. And in baseball, the ball always finds the guy who's out of position, and it always clangs off his glove, usually at a very important time. And that is part of what has happened with this series.
Okay. And now the Yankee series.
Well, the Yankees needed late-inning heroics to prevent a 0-2 record going into Minnesota, which might have been disastrous for them. The Twins are pretty good at home, and the Yankees' pitching, of course, is in disarray. But they got the late-inning heroics, so that series stands at 1 game each.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Red Sox are now crossing their fingers and hoping that the Yankees can pull it out.
At least that's the party line for some of these folks. Now, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that if you're a Red Sox fan, you might also go the other way and say the last thing you want to do is court the ghosts of the past and face the Yankees, even a somewhat diminished version of the Yankees, on the way to the World Series. But
wait,
you
court the ghosts of the past. That's all we do. Okay.
That's an excellent point, and I think that explains the headline.
Let's take a look at the National League, St. Louis and Los Angeles.
St. Louis is up 2-0 over the Dodgers. They've done it pretty much the same way that the Red Sox have done it to the Angels, with a lot of hitting. St. Louis had the best record in the major leagues over the course of the regular season, and they look terrific right now. Everybody's hitting, and they just look like they will be very tough to beat.
And then we've got the Houston-Atlanta series.
Yes, Roger Clemens, infamous for years for not being able to win the big one, won the big one, game one in the series between Houston and Atlanta.
Pitching for Houston, of course.
Pitching for Houston, mm-hmm. of course. And mm-hmm. boy, would it be fun if Clemens was pitching against either the Red Sox or the Yankees in the World Series. It'd be great fun because, of course, he won several Cy Young Awards with one team, Boston, and then World Series championship with the Yankees. Atlanta, similar to the Yankees, needed a comeback win in Game 2 to avoid going down, two games to none. They got it on a walk-off home run by a guy named Rafael Furcal, and Rafael Furcal may have more motivation to keep the season going than any other single player because as soon as the season is over, he goes to jail for drunken driving.
What?
Yeah, the judge sentenced him to jail time, but he said you don't have to serve it until after the Braves season is finished. So the wheels of American justice spin defensively along, as usual.
And talk about, as you said, incentive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you can keep the series going, if the Braves win this one and then they go seven games in the National League Championship Series and seven more in the World Series, the judge may forget. You know, he may be okay.
Yeah. What are some of your other favorite stories?
My favorite stories always in a situation like this depend on a best-of-five series going five games, and then in the next round and the round after that, a best-of-seven series going seven games. Because, you know, then you get the back and forth, and you get the plot lines developing, and you get the guy who goes 0 for 14 and then comes through, or you get the pitcher who is terrific in one game, and then they figure him out in the next one. These are the stories that I like to see.
The nuance. But what about the Red Sox hair? Should we explain? Johnny Damon of the Red Sox has this long head of hair, and Pedro, the pitcher, is growing his out as well. Mm-hmm. They all look slightly unkempt.
Yes, I think that may be the kind of image that they're courting now. And of course, there are people wandering around with their "What Would Johnny Damon Do?" buttons, and there's a kind of cult that's grown up around him. And whatever gets you through. One year it's rally caps. Another year for Anaheim it was the rally monkey. Maybe this year for Boston it's, showing up at the ballpark and looking as if maybe you really should be in a soup line. I don't know.
Looking as if you'd slept there. Well, Bill, you have any picks? I mean, you willing to go the distance now and say who you think it's going to be, not just for the playoffs, but for the whole thing?
Well, you have to say at this early point that it would be great fun if Boston were to face St. Louis in the World Series because at least as things are going now, the final scores of those games would be 21-19, 18-11, 17-14. I mean, you know, the hitting would be a great show to watch.
Do you agree that St. Louis has one of the best teams out there right now?
Oh, there's no question. Yeah, they were the most consistent and the most successful. They won more games than anybody else over the course of the regular season. So they have to be, at least in terms of the numbers, they have to be a favorite.
And, you know, I just one last thought from you, Bill. Who would have dreamed? A while back, people were saying, oh, no, the presidential debates are scheduled at the same time as scheduled the same time as the playoffs. And so people will watch baseball. But you know what? 61 million people watched that last presidential debate. Do you think this is going to be a tough choice for people tonight?
Well, I think this is the greatest argument for taping that we've had in some time. And my guess is that given the option, most people around here in the Boston area will watch the Red Sox in real time and then, you know, tape the debate.
Debates.
And their excuse will be, well, you know, I wanted to be able to really pay attention to those debates, maybe, you know, run the tape back and listen again as these gentlemen had said what they had to say.
Bill Littlefield, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. By the way, a song is making the rounds of Red Sox Nation. Holbrook, Massachusetts native and musician Joe Pernice of the Pernice Brothers has written an homage to Red Sox slugger Manny Ramirez. The song is called Moonshot Manny, or Pegaluna Manny in Spanish.
Pegaluna Manny.
Crazy.
Manny hit me home with
Sin. That song is available on the Panisse Brothers website. Go to ours, here-now.org, for the link. Panisse is asking for $1 to download the song, which he will then donate to First Night, Boston's New Year's celebration. Still to come, best-selling author Juliana Baggett. She borrowed from the life of her grandmother, who grew up in a brothel, to write her book, Madam. We'll talk with the author and her grandmother coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. Our five-part series on Iran concludes today with Vermont Public Radio's Steve Zinn's visit to the unofficial historian of his family, the 95-year-old keeper of the family flame, himself a direct descendant of the 18th-century king of Persia.
Near the end of our three-week stay in Iran, my brother and I traveled to Shiraz. The city's main street is Zand Boulevard. Our distant ancestor, Karim Khan Zand, made Shiraz his capital during his reign in the 1700s. He oversaw the construction of the bazaar and the Vakil Mosque, where swallows turn and dive over the courtyard. Karim Khan was a patron of the arts who built a tomb in Shiraz for Iran's most beloved poet, Hafez. Iranians love their poets. They've built monuments to them, as Americans have done for presidents. Many Iranians can recite Omar Khayyam, Rumi, and Hafez from memory. At night, the stone pavilion at Hafez's tomb is lit with an emerald light that spills into the surrounding gardens. Iranians crowd around the tomb and recite the poet's verse. One young man sings from a book of Hafez poetry. Shiraz was also the home of our grandfather's family. Finding out about them, their names and descendants, is a remote but tantalizing possibility. And so we visit Mr. Asadullah Bustani Izand. He's the keeper of the Zand flame, the only living direct descendant of Karim Khan. He's written articles about the Zand ruler and lobbied to restore and preserve Zand dynasty sites. A few years ago, Mr. Bustani Izand prevented Karim Khan's remains from being destroyed during excavation of an area near his fortress in Shiraz. At 95, Mr. Bustani Izand is brimming with good cheer and vitality. He has a full head of thick white hair combed straight back and a nose of historic proportions. We arrive unannounced, but he welcomes us graciously. He tells us that ever since he heard we might visit him, he's been looking forward to meeting the American Zands.
Please tell him the pleasure is ours. We are very happy to be here.
He leads us into his apartment, serves us drinks, and disappears. After a while, he returns dressed in a suit. The suit and the ornate decor of Mr. Bustani Izan's apartment reflect a bygone era. Over the mantel, there's a painting of Karim Khan Zand in his tall turban and beard. Beneath it is a framed certificate. Years ago, the Iranian government issued these to people who could prove they were Zands. The proof of Mr. Bustani Izan's ancestry is in the old documents he keeps in a brass tube. They're written in beautiful Persian calligraphy, and they trace his lineage back seven generations to Karim Khan Zand. He brings out two thick books written in Farsi that tell about his family's history in Shiraz, but nothing in them sheds light on our grandfather's family. After all, we have only a handful of stories and the name of our grandfather, who was born over 150 years ago. It's too little to go on. Mr. Bustani Izan serves us cookies and a sweet drink called sakanjabin, made from basil, vinegar, and sugar.
Can we propose a toast to Mr. Bustani Zand and the Zand family?
The Zand tribe.
We've reached the high point and the end of our journey in Iran. We've followed the thread of our grandfather's story as far as we can. We've been welcomed by people who share our name in the village where our ancestors were born. And we've raised a glass with a distinguished family patriarch. We may not have found the names of our grandfather's family, but we have found his people, warm and gracious to a fault, proud of their culture, and curious about the world outside. My brother and I were able to come here because of our Iranian heritage. The United States and Iran don't have diplomatic relations, and Iran doesn't give visas to Americans who want to travel the country as we have. Because of long-standing tensions in the Mideast and differences in ideology, this is unlikely to change for many years. For most Americans, the Iran we've experienced will remain hidden, a half a world away.
Our week-long visit to Iran was produced by Vermont Public Radio's Steve Zind with help from Sam Sanders. For photos from Steve's trip, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The book The Madam by best-selling author Juliana Baggett is a work of fiction, but it's inspired by the real-life story of her great-grandmother and her grandmother, Mildred Lane. The book is set in the 1920s in a brothel, and like the characters in the book, Juliana's grandmother grew up in a house of prostitution run by her mother. The book is recently out in paperback, and we spoke to author Juliana Baggett and her grandmother last year when Mildred shared with us her feelings about seeing her story told in a novel.
No, that doesn't bother me at all. See, my life is just an open book. I never have been a secretive person. The times were very hard during that depression, and my mother, she just could not make enough money to support us and give us the proper food to eat and a proper place to live. So she just chose a profession that she could do, and so she opened this house.
Well, your life is not only an open book, it is a book written by your granddaughter. And Juliana, did you grow up knowing the story of your great-grandmother's brothel?
I did grow up knowing it. My mother didn't find out that her grandmother had been a madam of a whorehouse until she was married, until after she was married. My father was the one who told her. He figured it out from conversations on porches and things.
Right. Well, and now, as we said, it is an open secret. And the very first sentence of the book pulls you into the fictional story that you've written around this true life family story. Mildred, I'm going to read the first line of the book here. Before there can be a murderous heart, or for that matter, before there can be a whorehouse, an orphanage, a dank trunk with rusted hinges, there must first be a hosiery mill. Juliana, you start the book in this hosiery mill where the character Alma is eking out a bleak existence making stockings.
That's right.
Was that true? Was that a true?
Oh, yes, that's true. She worked in a mill, and she was really just a child, too. You know, they had child labor back in those days.
Now, Mildred, this was your mother.
That was my mother, and my grandmother also worked in a hosiery mill, too.
And Alma and her husband make a gut-wrenching decision to get off this dead-end road and travel to Florida. As part of this misadventure, Juliana, we find that Alma, your character, but in real life, your great-grandmother, has to leave her children in an orphanage. This must have been gut-wrenching for you to write, Juliana.
It really was, and it was very hard for me. In fact, it was the breaking point of the novel. I walked into that, and in reality, my grandmother was left at an orphanage more than once, and I realized that it was hard times and all of that kind of stuff, but I couldn't get over it. My great-grandmother had three children. I have three children, and I found myself judging her. And I was actually disengaging from her and looking at her in a way that, how could you do this? How could you do this? And so I really had to become her.
Boy, back to your grandmother. Mildred, it sounds as if your granddaughter was a little more upset with your mother's decision to leave you in an orphanage, and then ultimately through the storyline, she does become the madam of a brothel. But it sounds as if Juliana's a little more upset with her, at least she was, than you were.
No, I wasn't upset with my mother at the time because I was young, and I didn't realize a lot of things. I didn't have any idea that a whorehouse was going to be the answer to some of her problems financially. She was trying to get settled.
Well, the home that you eventually lived in was a brothel, and I want Juliana to read a passage. Why don't you set it up for us? This is when Letty, the character, but this is actually Mildred, your grandmother.
This is after Letty she's been in the whorehouse as a young girl, very protected from everything for about 5 years. So she's now 15, which is starting to become a dangerous age to still be there. And I think that was also the case with my grandmother. It became a point in time where she was too pretty and still too young to be in this environment. Letty doesn't despise the men who come to her mother's house. In fact, sometimes she pretends her father is among them. She listens to the hoot and clomp, the deep bass voices, and chooses one to latch onto and follow. Fathers have become strange to her. She's seen them in town, Sunday dressed, leading stiff processions into churchyards, their furred necks shaven to a bright pink. But she sees them here, too, where they come to crow. They're big, loud, they wipe their wet hands on their backsides and rattle up spit from deep in their chests, bear-like. Sometimes she pretends that the men downstairs are a house full of fathers just for her, joyful, rowdy, all clamoring to see their little girl. She has created the notion that her mother doesn't run a whorehouse, but an orphanage for wayward fathers. This is when she hates her mother for not letting her downstairs to claim her father from the abundant choices.
Mildred, what was it like for you to read about those childhood experiences that you had?
Well, I cried. And so I told Julie, that I called Julie Julie, that's my little pet name for her, that it made me cry because she got the feeling right there, you know. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do this. But her book is so beautiful and loving, and that's what my life was all about, love, because my mother loved us very, very much, and she was good to us, and we didn't see bad things, and we lived a normal life, excepting my mother was, you know, making a living with these ladies. And the ladies were not young girls like you see in movies today. Mm-hmm. They were altogether different. They looked like just housewives, and they were mature. And they were treated as ladies in my mother's house because my mother was very strict. The house was very orderly run, and it was things were discreet.
Well, Juliana, that's quite powerful to be able to, you know, provide in your writing that kind of a, I don't know, validation for your own grandmother.
Yeah. Do you think that, don't you think that she'd captured it all well?
Well,
from what I tell you?
From what you tell me, yes.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's funny. This book has been very relaxing for me. You know, I often get, you know, this is my third novel, and with the first two, I was very, very uptight about reviews, and I was really anxious about getting on lists and all that kind of stuff. And with this one, after my grandmother, you know, it was one time when she read it in book form after it was out, and I walked in, and she was crying, and she, you know, I just kind of got down on my knees and hugged her, and I thought, well, you know, I cannot care how the rest of the world takes this book. My work is done. You know, what I set out to do for this family and in kind of healing her, but also giving voice to my mother who couldn't voice these stories herself either. There's a real feeling of accomplishment and ending there.
And it turns out it is a good read.
I think it shows the strength of my mother. She was a very, very strong woman.
Well, apparently there was more than one in this family. Mildred, thank you so much.
Well, you are quite welcome, and you all have a good day.
Okay.
Bye, Julie.
Bye-bye.
Juliana Baggett, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Our conversation with Juliana Baggett, author of the book The Madam, a Novel, which has recently been released in paperback. Her grandmother, Mildred Lane, also joined us on the line from Newark, Delaware. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.